This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education, by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts. This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or stream us live on YouTube and Bloomberg.com.
Bloomberg Business Week magazine, it's on the shelves right now, as the kids used to say. The cover is the Bloomberg 50, the people who defined global business in 2022. And Mike Regan, I know you'll be shocked to find out that I am not on it. I did not make the list.
Snubbed again, Paul.
Snubbed again. Exactly. But we've got the person responsible for that, Brent Beegan. He's a senior editor at Bloomberg Business Week, joining us via Zoom from New York City. So, Brett, the 50 folks who really defined global business in 2022. Talk to us about maybe some themes that emerged from your list this year.
So I would say that the biggest theme that emerged is the tentacles, really, that the war in Ukraine had. So we have, obviously, Volodymyr Zelensky is on the list. But then when you start to look into other industries, you see people like in the finance world, like Dalip Singh, who was the architect of the sanctions regime against Putin. He's on our list. And then even people like Todd Boehly, who winds up investing and buying the Chelsea Football Club after the Russian oligarch Roman Abramovich was pressured to sell it. So that was one of the sort of major themes. And then I would say it was also sort of hard to avoid what's going on in crypto and the crypto winter. So we had some familiar names like Serena Williams, who's raising money, including investing in some crypto stuff, people like Katie Hahn. And up until about a month ago, we thought we were going to have someone with the initials SBF on the list, but we wound up putting his replacement, John Ray, on instead.
Okay.
Right. Certainly an influential character, but I guess not the type you want on this particular list. My favorite, though, Brett, is Bad Bunny.
Yes.
For those who are on, Paul, you
Yeah,
you're familiar
I don't
with
know
Bad
what's
Bunny?
Going on. Explain that one to me.
Reggaeton, man.
Oh,
reggaeton.
Okay. There you go.
What's he doing on there, Brett?
Yeah. So Bad Bunny is kind of fascinating. You know, he sort of emerges in the pandemic from, he's really sort of first recognized when he was a teen for his work on SoundCloud, and has been an incredibly prolific musician in the last couple of years. And that really culminated this year in him selling more tickets to concerts and having the number one album of the year, when he had competition from some huge names, Harry Styles, Beyonce, BTS, et cetera. So no one had a bigger tour this year and no one had a bigger album this year than Bad Bunny. And he really appeals to like a Gen Z crowd. He sort of challenges gender norms. And his music's great.
Any surprises for you this year?
I mean, there are always surprises to me. I would say that we look at people like someone like a Tom Oxley, who makes the list, because when you try to explain what he does, it's not just surprising, it's sort of shocking. He's a neuroscientist and entrepreneur who is looking into the world of brain-computer interfaces and has successfully implanted a device that essentially allows people who are suffering from things like ALS to communicate via their thoughts. You know, in the world of science fiction, we've heard about this for, you know, years, and it's always been something in novels. but he's actually making it happen. In Australia, in this trial run, they were able to get people to actually send emails using this technology and to order things online. So learning about people like that is always one of the most fascinating parts of putting this list together.
You know, Brett, one name that jumped out in my world of market coverage is Ken Griffin, billionaire founder of Citadel. What caught your eye with him this year?
Yeah, Ken Griffin is, you know, fascinating in normal times, but this move to Miami, he's not the first to do it, but he is certainly the wealthiest, certainly the richest to do it. And he's really signaling a move down there and an attempt to make Miami into, I think, what we refer to as Wall Street South. He's building a tower down there that I believe he's estimated to be at about $1 billion. And there's also just a, you know, fascinating backstory here with him wanting to leave Illinois because of his battles with J.B. Pritzker there, and to go down to Florida, which is generally perceived as being more business friendly, where the governor is Ron DeSantis, and Griffin is one of his biggest contributors. So this is like a story within a story within a story on that one.
You know, I was glad to see Nick Hayek on because I interviewed him earlier this week, and in doing research, he's the president and CEO of the Swatch Group in Switzerland. I didn't know that the Swatch Group was the biggest watch company in the world. They have a huge market cap. Just a fascinating story when I did the research. Interesting to find them on your Bloomberg Business Week 50.
Yeah, Nick Hayek is like, you know, it's a very 2022 story. He's the kind of person who, you know, wouldn't have made it on last year and probably won't make it on next year. But the Moon Swatch is this genius stroke that he had where they basically took a Swatch and
which is one of the lower end brands.
Right. And they combined that with Omega, which is one of their higher end brands. And you had a watch that would normally cost about $7,000. And they swapped out basically the parts to make it a $250 watch. And it was wildly popular. I actually looked for one even as recently as about a week ago. And I walked into the boutique, the Swatch boutique, and they said they almost knew exactly why I was there. And they said, we don't have any. You know, like almost right off the bat. And this is months and months and months after this partnership. So it was really, really just a genius stroke. The watches are super cool. And you basically get to own this iconic watch, timepiece, but you only have to spend $250 on it versus the $7,000 that the original would cost.
Another one, someone I did not know of, Pinky Cole.
Yes.
I'm not sure if you're allowed to say the name of her restaurant.
I think you can.
Is this a family program?
Tell us the name of
Business Week put it in print.
Yeah, true.
We did. And our alert compliance flagged me every single time. So Pinky Cole was fascinating. She raised $25 million this year with the help of Danny Meyer of Shake Shack fame and, of course, of Unisquare, et cetera. So she started a vegan burger chain called Slutty Vegan. And, you know, it's basically fast food for vegans. She was trying to change people's perception of vegan food from like tofu bowls and grain bowls. And she liked junk food and wanted to be able to eat junk food. So she named it Slutty Vegan basically so that we would talk about it, so that people would laugh and joke about it.
Success.
And the burgers all have fun names like Hollywood Hooker, Menage a Trois, One Night Stand. It's great.
That's fun. All right. That's good. It's a great collection and milieu of different people on there. It's a great read. So I suggest people run out to the, you know, you can go out to the, you know, place and get magazines, right? You can do that still.
Yeah.
Plus, you can do it on that Bloomberg.com.
Penn Station, when I go through Penn Station.
Exactly. All right. Good stuff. Brent Biegun, senior editor, Bloomberg Business Week, joining us via Zoom from New York City. And it's a really good collection of diverse individuals. I got the usual suspects, you know, kind of the big players out there. But there's also some new ones. Serena Williams, I saw, was on there too, which is really cool. So
Tom Cruise back in the book.
Oh, he is. Good news for him. All right, this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, Elon Musk, no surprise, I guess, Michael, still in the news. But now he's saying, okay, now I'm really done. I'm really done selling stock, and I mean it this time. I don't know. We've heard that before. Let's bring in Sarah Fryer. She's a big tech team leader for Bloomberg News. She's also the author of No Filter, The Inside Story of Instagram. She's joins us on Zoom from San Francisco. Sarah, do we believe him this time? I know you were in the Twitter Spaces call yesterday, and I guess some shareholders weren't too happy. What do you think?
Well, I think it's difficult to say whether we believe him. Certainly, it's what he has promised. I think shareholders were also really interested in what he said right afterwards, which is that he will be spending more of his time on Tesla going forward. They felt he was distracted by the Twitter project. They said, you know, why didn't you come back to this company that is a much bigger part of your life and net worth? He said, don't worry. Tesla is way more complex than Twitter ever will be. He said Twitter has about 10% of the complexity of Tesla. So, of course, he will need to be spending more of his attention on that company going forward, which shareholders are happy to hear. But then they confronted him with this problem they have with how he has brought so much political controversy into his run of Twitter, bringing back people who had been banned and making his own proclamations about politics and causing a lot of people who loved his brand, including these investors, to feel a little alienated and to feel a little different riding around in their Teslas and being owners of Tesla stock. And what I thought was really interesting is he responded to those fears by saying, of course I'm not going to stop talking about politics just to satisfy shareholders. Of course not. And I don't think that they were very pleased to hear that.
Not pleased, but probably not surprised either. Yeah. I would guess if you know anything about Elon. But sir, I wonder if he got into sort of any of the nitty gritty on Tesla's business, because obviously, the stock's taken a huge hit this year, but especially this week, that those news of the $7,500 discount on some models seemed to really knock a lot off the stock. It was down something like 8 or 9% that day. Did he talk about that at all, or really any of the sort of demand dynamics for Tesla going forward?
Well, he tied it to the economy. He tied it to the interest rate environment, the inflationary environment. I think that, what he was trying to get across to these investors is look, this is what's happening in the industry at large, and we're just kind of rolling with the trend here. And I don't know that when you look at Tesla compared to the rest of the market, it is being hit a little harder. So I don't know if that was a satisfying answer for his investors.
Sarah, you're out there in San Francisco. You know all of these companies. You know a lot of the Silicon Valley investors there on Sand Hill Road. Palo Alto, is there a sense that Twitter, there's even a place for Twitter as a business? I mean, you've got Amazon now in the advertising business, obviously Facebook and Instagram, Google. Where does Twitter fit in? Can it be fixed?
Well, Twitter isn't really replicated by any of those other businesses because it is a very real-time product. People go to Twitter to figure out what's happening now. And I think that if you're going to Instagram, if you're going to Facebook, if you're going to TikTok, it's more about entertainment around, spending the few minutes you have while you're waiting for an Uber. So I think that the place Twitter has in our conversation, that's what Musk was drawn to, this idea that you would control this extremely powerful communication platform where you see politicians, celebrities, athletes, actors, journalists sharing what's happening to them in real time and what they're thinking. That said, Twitter as a business has always been rather niche, in one part because advertisers don't really feel the need to be tied to a place of controversy or a place where anything can happen related to the news. It's much safer if you're an advertiser to play on a platform that is more about making people feel good and more about entertainment. So it's always been a little bit of a struggle for them to grow. And of course, not everyone in the public needs to know what's happening right at the moment it's happening. As journalists, we're rather addicted to that and part of the engine of that. But regular people don't need to be glued to Twitter all day.
Yeah, sorry, I wonder if it's possible to get a sort of vibe check on what these shareholders were like during this Spaces Q&A yesterday. You know, did they seem angry? Do they seem like they're itching to hit that sell button? Or is it more a matter of, come on, Elon, we're on board, but we need you to do this, that, and the other thing?
Very much the latter. I mean, I think a lot of things that Musk would say, the shareholders would say, oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I get it. I just want to, you know, are you punching down when you talk about trans rights? Are you punching down when you do this, your political commentary that you do? How can we tell our daughters or our sons that we admire you as you've really changed your public persona and taken on so much controversy with this Twitter bid? And I think that's something that he didn't really answer to their satisfaction. I think they were very much just trying to communicate to him, like, man, we're on your side. Like, we really want to see this turn around. It's in all of our financial interests. And he was like, hey, like, this is who I am. And I have great things in store for the future.
Yeah. So, Sarah, one of the next things I guess we'll see in terms of Twitter as a business is CEO. Are they going to hire a CEO? Now, I can't imagine taking that position, given that Elon, A, it's Elon Musk, B, he's still going to be involved in the company. Any rumblings out there in the Valley about who might get the job, want the job?
Well, Musk, for his part, says that anybody who wants it is probably not qualified. So, you know, maybe you have to not want it and have Musk come call on you and say, will you step up to the plate? But it's going to be a really complicated position, because not only do you have to run this company where Musk is still financially in control, he says that he wants to remain in charge of engineering and software and servers. So he's still going to be a larger than life presence in the office, if not, you know, making a lot of the decisions still. And you need somebody who can cater to that while at the same time putting the business in the direction where it can succeed. And right. Musk has said that it's been on the path to bankruptcy since May. I don't know if that's hyperbolic or not, but certainly Twitter has taken on a lot of debt that Musk borrowed in order to finance this transaction.
Yep.
And so, you know, he explained that they were, prior to his cuts, they'd be on track to spend way more than they make.
Right. All right, Sarah, great stuff. I know we're going to continue talking to you over the coming days and months and on this issue, because it just seems to be the story that keeps on giving. Sarah Friar, she's a big tech team leader, Bloomberg News. She's also the author of No Filter, the inside story of Instagram. She joins us on Zoom from San Francisco, talking a little Elon Musk and a little Tesla. We'll have more coming up.
When cybercriminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at QuickBooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, let's be honest here. 2022, stocks, disaster. Bonds, even more of a disaster, like epic proportions disaster, right? That's what the fixed income people tell me. They've never seen it, ever, performance.
Don't even get started on crypto then.
Don't even get started on crypto. Let's talk about another kind of hot item with the kids, ETFs.
ETFs, this is a surprising turn of events for ETFs.
Right.
And I think Emily's going to explain it to us all.
All right. Emily Garfeo, she's cross-asset reporter for Bloomberg News, joining us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. Is cross-asset reporter just another way to say ETF reporter? Because you and Katie Greifeld, she's also a cross-asset reporter, but she talks a lot about ETFs.
Cross-asset is everything. Okay. Every little thing, but ETFs does fall under our coverage, and we love them. So,
all right, so how is 2022 highs, lows? Just give us the 30,000-foot picture.
Okay, so 30,000-foot picture, we obviously have had a bear market in stocks, but not every ETF has done poorly. The ones you would imagine have done well in the equity side, the energy linked stocks, the crypto linked ones have done poorly. But then when you look at the more alternative space, the commodity funds have done really well. And then some hedge fund tracking, hedge fund style ETFs.
So they're ETFs that'll track hedge fund type.
Hedge fund strategies. Okay. One is a managed futures one, so that's a specific like trend following strategy. Yeah. I know, Mike, you had Andrew Beer on your What Goes Up podcast a few months ago.
Nice plug.
What a nice little plug. And unexpected little plug.
But that fund has done incredibly well this year. It's up about 20% year to date. It started 2022 with about $60 million in assets, and it crossed over $1 billion in just months. So a lot of interest there in terms of flows into those kind of alternatives. Strategies.
What really shocked me, though, is, you know, Paul and I were talking about how the IPO market was basically dead in 2022 for good reason. Who wants to try to float an IPO in this market? But how many new ETFs? My eyes popped out of my head when I saw this.
Yeah. So right now, the tally is 422 new ETFs.
422.
And that's a record. We had a record last year.
Emily's written about every one of them.
Yes, exactly.
Every PR person has pitched me on their brand new ETF. But we had a record last year, and then this is another year, which is surprising because you wouldn't think that.
Any common theme among them? You know, I'm sure that they're not all exactly the same strategy, all 422, but any themes pop out?
Well, there were a lot of like interest rate hedging strategies. Mm-hmm. Everyone was trying to kind of figure out like how do we position for the bear market in bonds. So some of them were more successful than others. Some of the funds were betting on the yield curve steepening, and then some were betting more on inflation depending on the kind of derivatives that they had in the fund. So it was a mixed bag for those. And then there were still a lot of ESG funds coming out, which was surprising given the year that ESG has had. But there is some appetite, at least on the issuer side, to launch a fund with that kind of label in it.
Yeah, and I guess some of these are years in the making. So, you get them across the finish line when it's the right time or not.
But
another thing that really boggles my mind this year is Cathie Wood's Innovation Fund had a very awful year. You know, those high growth tech stocks, not so high on the profits yet, just got clobbered this year. She actually had inflows this year, though.
Did she?
She did.
Wow.
Yeah, over $1 billion, yeah.
Well, I wonder, is that play out across that whole sort of growth tech innovation strategy, or is it just her special mojo, do you think?
I don't have the details of every single tech ETF, but I do know that there are fans that just, they love ARK. They want to hold on. I was actually talking about it with a source this morning who was kind enough to take my call on Christmas Eve, who was saying that there are these people that she has a long-term thesis. They feel like they're making the right call by investing for the longer term. So even though the fund has fallen, they're still interested in this innovation theme.
What is an active ETF fund?
So an active ETF, normally when retail investors think of ETFs, they usually think of funds that track indexes, index funds, passive strategy. But we're seeing the growth of ETFs that have active managers that actively buy and sell and change the weightings of different stocks. And so what we've really seen this year in 2022 is these large legacy asset managers companies that are known for their actively managed mutual funds launching ETFs. Capital Group was the big kahuna this
February.
Now, can
they do that with the still the low-cost structure that make ETFs the cool thing?
Most of the time, the active ETFs are lower fee than the mutual fund.
I still have to pay the manager, which was the whole part of the lower fees was there's nobody really I had to pay. I didn't have to pay some star portfolio manager.
Yeah, the fee, it's lower than the mutual fund, okay. But it's more expensive than a passive ETF across the board, okay. For the most part.
Yeah, Paul, Emily's smart to call sources on 2 days before Christmas. Yeah. You might get them with a few eggnogs in them,
right,
you
exactly.
know, tell you a little bit more than they had planned. But
yeah, well, I understand.
But Emily, you know, there's so many players in the ETF space now. Is anyone making ground on the big two? You know, BlackRock, yeah. Vanguard, obviously have dominated the space for years, but they're, you know, getting attacked from all sides with different strategies and different new products. Are they making any headways, all these upstart competitors?
Yeah, I mean, the big asset managers are starting to reach the top, reach Vanguard and BlackRock. We don't think that the assets are going to replace or get bigger than Vanguard or BlackRock. But three names that I'm watching, Dimensional, JP Morgan, and Capital Group. They had some of the most successful ETF launches in 2022. This is from Bloomberg Intelligence. They've taken in 68% of the assets gathered by all of the new ETF set of launches. 68% of the assets went to those three companies. So they have been able, and they're launching this active strategy, which some strategists were doubtful that active would take a place in the ETF world.
But I guess in some way, maybe they're cannibalizing a little their mutual fund business.
Yes, we are seeing a lot of companies, Fidelity too, converting their mutual
That's
funds
what I want to ask
into
about.
ETFs.
That's a thing? You
yes.
can do that?
Yes. So it started in 2021, and we're seeing now there's a tool on
the
terminal.
Are they just going to throw it in the towel? I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, I was about to plug
I'm always
the
looking
terminal.
For the tools on the terminal.
There's a new tool. Bloomberg Intelligence keeps a tally of how many. I think it's a little bit over 35 now. Mutual funds have flipped to ETFs. But it is a little bit of saving yourself, not wanting the competitor to launch an ETF. So you're going to do it yourself.
I mean, is there any future? I don't know. Michael, you might know too. Like for the traditional mutual fund structures, is there a future there that we all grew up with? Or I don't know.
I mean, it seems like they're going to die by a million cuts with all these conversions to ETFs and ETFs that replicate the same strategies.
Because I grew up as an analyst,
and I have a lot of mutual fund
manager
friends who are going to. I'm going to hear about this. Hopefully, they're not listening today.
I started my career as an analyst, and you had to go to Boston.
Yep.
Three or four times a year. And the great thing about it is you could just take within a 10-minute walk radius, Fidelity, Putnam, Welling. I mean, the big money managers in the world. Mm-hmm. And boom, they were right there. But I'm wondering about that business now.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of those names that you mentioned, I saw them at the ETF conferences that I attended this year. The one thing that I think is keeping mutual funds still in business is that in a lot of retirement accounts, it doesn't really make sense to have the ETF, the tax advantages of the ETF. It's kind of canceled out by the retirement accounts. So until that changes, we probably won't see a very large flip and a complete death of mutual funds. So they'll stick around.
The conference schedule cracks me up. ETFs and crypto are keeping the conference industry alive, I think.
And I don't see any like ETF conferences in Milwaukee.
Right.
January. you know, there's
always a nice
Beach,
golf course nearby. Golf course, yeah. Bring your sunscreen, that sort of thing.
All right. So, Emily, good stuff. We're going to let you cross asset. I'm just going to call them ETF / crypto reporters.
It's like the fancy poo meme. Yep. Have you seen that? You know, ETF reporter.
Okay.
And put a tuxedo on poo and they're a cross asset.
Exactly. Reporter. All right. I'm Emily Garfeo, cross asset reporter, Bloomberg News, joining us here on our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec on Bloomberg Radio.
Let's talk a little crypto, but maybe from a little bit different angle. Bruce Rogers, Chairman, CEO, and President of LM Funding, its ticker's LMFA, joins us via Zoom from Tampa, Florida, where I think even the cold weather is going to reach Tampa. Bruce, are you guys getting ready for a little bit chillier than usual Christmas down in Tampa?
Sure. It was 70 and sunny when I came in, so I wore my leather jacket.
Good for you. Well, somehow try to bear through it. Bruce, talk to us about LM Funding. What do you guys do? How do you participate in the crypto space?
Well, we made a pivot into Bitcoin a year ago as a outpouring of an effort to do a SPAC. So we funded a SPAC and looked at a bunch of different industries to pivot our LMFA ticker and landed on Bitcoin mining. And the reason we landed on that seems like it's bearing its way out. We looked at a lot of exchanges and a lot of the different DeFi plays, and I just never, as a lawyer, could come to grips with the regulations on that. So we started buying Bitcoin and put it on our balance sheet, kind of the MicroStrategies piece. And then I realized the cheapest way to buy Bitcoin, if you believe in this stuff, is to mine it. And so we bought a bunch of mining machines at the peak of the market, fortunately with a variable price contract. So we didn't get burned too badly. And now we're up and mining in the Bitcoin winter at the hardest of times. But I still believe in Bitcoin and what it can do. And it solves the trust problem between humans. And it does so by having lots and lots of humans participate in every transaction. So that's the story of why Bitcoin for us.
Yeah, Bruce, talk to us a little bit about the climate for miners these days. You know, we did have Core Scientific, one of the largest miners of Bitcoin, file for bankruptcy protection earlier in the month. What are the challenges facing Bitcoin miners? Obviously, the drop in prices is one. Leverage. What's going on in the space in general? Are we going to see more sort of bankruptcies or failures like we saw with Core Scientific?
I think that anybody that levered up a year ago and the asset that we're all betting on to make us money is down 85%, that leverage is going to be very hard to pay back. So I feel very fortunate in that we did not lever up and we're entirely cash-based company. The overall, it's as bad as it could be, but it can always get worse. You know what I mean? Gas prices are up, so winter's cold. Electricity is going to be expensive. We've tried three different approaches to getting machines hosted. We went with the startup entrepreneurial guy and he went bust. And then we said, nope, we're going to go big balance sheets for our hosts. So we went to Compute North and they went bust. And we're still kind of working our way out of that.
Oh, geez.
And we moved a bunch of our Core machines a bunch of our Compute North machines to Core. And fortunately there, that seems to be working out well. I've reviewed their plan and it looks like that we're going to be able to stay energized based on what they've informed us so far.
So, Bruce, just looking at your background, originally from Bowling Green, Kentucky, and just so you know, I'm a huge fan of Bowling Green, Kentucky. I've spent a lot of time there. And I also note that you're in the United States Navy for 4 years and the surface warfare officer. So thank you for your service. My question to you here is, the Bitcoin mining, I mean, that seems like the nuts and bolts of the business, and I get that. And that's where you guys are focused in. But when you see a big exchange like FTX blow up and, you know, Sam Bankman fine, what does that mean to you as an industry participant? How crippling is that, if it is at all, or in terms of credibility?
There's nothing good about it other than I guess it gets this out of the way. I thought as a Bitcoin miner, I did not buy into the DeFi thing. When we were looking at different companies with our SPACs, I could not figure out what securities laws they were trying to comply with and found out they weren't. So there was some scadding forward there and watching it fail. But what I didn't realize is that our hosting companies were intertwined with the DeFi situation and that it sucks some liquidity out of the coin and it sucks some, it's put some miners into a bad place because of the financing. The whole DeFi thing to me, I heard this, it was either late night TV or maybe on Bloomberg, and somebody compared it to the Wright brothers financing their company by selling frequent flyer miles. And I loved it because I thought through the example, and it is kind of what Sam Bankman-Fried and the Magic Box were talking about. You know, they just had, here we got an idea, we got this idea, it's going to be a wing, and we're going to run down a dune into the wind, and we're going to fly. And so what we think you should do is buy tickets on these planes that are going to shuttle people over around Earth. And it would have worked out, well, it really wouldn't have worked because the airline business turned out not to be so good and so forth. But even if they'd have done it, it had taken the time delay in flying and the first flight was a little bit and people would have got antsy. So they would have had to invent the stable coin too. And we would have got through that whole thing if the Wright brothers done it. The irony is the Wright brothers could have financed their operations by selling frequent flyer miles because it wasn't illegal back then.
You know, Bruce, it's good to hear that, you know, your company's not levered up like some of these other miners and maybe can weather this this turmoil in the market a lot better than those that were. But I wonder what, if any, risk there is to Bitcoin as more miners struggle and, you know, if they do start failing, unplugging the rigs. Is there a risk to sort of, I don't know, the integrity of Bitcoin or the transaction times or anything if a lot of miners fail? Or is it just, you know, the last company standing like yourself just get more of the pie?
Well, Bitcoin has lots of built-in features, but the degree of difficulty, the more miners plugged in, the harder it is to mine. So if miners fall offline, you know, take it to the logical extremes, it becomes easier and easier. So the actual transaction in the coin and the yield is calculated to be about the same over periods of time. And that's why we say the last coin will be mined in 2140.
So you got some time there.
Yeah. One of my board members was just in the office. He said, I think we got till 2040. I said, Fred, this none of the math works if that's true. So you got to live with me on that.
Double check that date.
Yeah. So, Bruce, talk to us about one of the other aspects of mining. It's just the power issue. What's your strategy there? How do you kind of maximize that?
So we're driven by capital. And so to us, it's the cost of capital to get Bitcoin. And I don't want to buy infrastructure right now if I can avoid it. 30-year infrastructure to mine Bitcoin, I would rather pay per kilowatt. So we do everything through hosting companies like Core and Compute North that they upcharge us on the cost of electricity and the infrastructure. So that's been our approach to it. And then with that, we're kind of like outsourcing the dealing with the local politics of Bitcoin mining is loud and it throws off a lot of heat. So there are neighbors that aren't going to like that.
So where are your machines physically? I mean, are they just in an IT office park kind of thing? Where do you house them? Or where are they? Maybe not just you yourselves, but just the industry.
So just relying on public information, we house a bunch of them at Core Scientific and specifically at their Calvert City, Kentucky facility. Yeah, I won the High Point Award there at age 9, so I came back 50 years later to spend some money. That facility, if I recall, used to be a steel facility, so it had great power access. There's a new facility out there in the western part of the state of Kentucky, and so that brings you to the energy piece, which is, you know, if you're on the grid, you're getting whatever energy's in the grid. And that's where we are.
All right. That's good stuff. Two thumbs up for Kentucky. Again, I'm a big fan of bowling here in Kentucky. You didn't know that, Mike. Yeah.
big bourbon guy over there, Paul.
Yeah, exactly. Bruce Rogers, Chairman, CEO, and President of LM Funding, joining us on Zoom from Tampa, Florida. And, you know, that whole mining aspect, it's just fascinating. My understanding level is relatively elemental, but I mean, just the concept of just, you know, cranking out code and then just kind of running it and the power associated with running those machines. And,
you know, it was interesting too to hear Bruce, you know, that sort of skeptical lawyer's mind figure out this is the avenue least likely to get everyone in trouble, which is interesting.
It's good stuff. All right. Good stuff. That was Bruce Rogers.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at QuickBooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, Mike, it's December Eve, 2022 for me, so in the rear view, as the kids say. I mean, stocks down 20%+. I got bonds down double digits. Enough. I'm looking forward to 2023, and I want to talk to somebody. Maybe you can give me some good news.
It's not like you wanted to retire ever, Paul.
No, exactly. So I love this working thing. So, and as Tom Keene refers to the 401k, the 201k. So, Michael Sheldon, he's the Executive Director and Chief Investment Officer for Hightower RDM Financial Group. He joins us via Zoom from Westport, Connecticut. Michael, I don't care about 2022. Give me your call. What's the letter that, what was in your letter that you sent out to your clients preparing them for 2023?
Well, I think as we, obviously 2022 is certainly a roller coaster of the year. As we look ahead to 2023, ultimately we're seeing some weakness in the economy in the first half of the year. Either a slowdown in the economy or a shallow recession appears likely. If you look at some of the data, for example, the leading economic indicator has been negative for 9 months in a row. The yield curve continues to point to some weakness. That's the difference between short and long-term rates. Ultimately, the Fed wants to see, I think, 3 or 4 months in a row of positive, meaning inflationary data that's moving in the right direction. Today's data, you talked about the PCE data. There were no surprises in that, and that's the good news. The core number, which the Fed watches, fell from 5% to 4.7% on a year-over-year basis, and that's the lowest, actually, since the fall of 2021. So I think the Fed wants to see more positive inflation data, and ultimately that will lead to a shift in Fed policy probably in the spring of next year, after the Fed probably raises rates to 5 to 5.25%. And we see some possible weakness in the first half of the year, but then ultimately we see things recovering as investors start to look ahead to a rebound in the economy and corporate profits as we head into 2024.
So Michael, what does that shift in Fed policy or at least communications look like to you? Is it presumably not an actual cut in rates, but at least the end of the tightening?
Yeah, I think, if you look at past cycles when the Fed has cut rates, the markets have rallied. In this situation, we're likely to see the Fed shift policy first by indicating that they're moving to the sidelines because inflationary data has started to improve, but maybe they haven't met all of their criteria just yet. So we will probably see rates stay at 5 to 5.25% through much of next year, unless things really change or the credit markets freeze up, which we don't see at this point. So I think that Fed shifting policy to sort of a more of a neutral bias will create a more positive environment for the markets. One of the big questions we're thinking about is what kind of weakness or what kind of recession we see next year. And some people think it'll be more serious. We think it'll probably be shallow. For example, if you look at the last 9 recessions, the unemployment rate rose each of those times on average by 3.4%. So this time around, that would mean the unemployment rate would rise to over 7%. But given the labor market challenges that we see right now, companies are still trying to hire a lot of workers. We see some layoffs, but we don't think that we're going to see the kind of economic downturn that we saw, for example, in 08 or 2001, 2002.
Yeah, it's tough to see kind of those types of unemployment rates when you got a JOLTS number that's still over
10 million.
Right? 10 million. So
that's right.
Michael, talk to us about the consumer here. As we all know, the consumer, you know, it's generally hanging in there. The consumer has a job if he or she wants one. Yes, their savings have been run down. Yes, they're running up in credit card debt. But, you know, we had some good numbers out of Nike and some others recently. How are you thinking about the consumer going into 23?
Yeah, it's important to keep an eye on the consumer because that represents about 2/3 of the U.S. economy. So, I mean, looking backwards, if you look at some of the jobs data, we've created more than 200,000 jobs per month in each of the last 3 months. So granted, we had a hole to climb out of COVID. The unemployment rate right now is around 3.7%, which is the lowest level almost since 1969, and wages are rising at a more than 5% rate. So at the same time, that wage rate is one of the sticky things that Powell is trying to bring down. There are some signs that consumer spending will slow. Equity markets and financial markets in general have been volatile, and we're likely to see some more layoffs as we head into next year. But overall, the consumer overall is generally on pretty good footing, but we do see some slowing in consumer spending during the first half of next year before things likely pick up again.
You know, Michael, with these interest rates expected pretty much by everyone, and you included, to stay relatively elevated, say the Fed funds rate above 5% for 2023, I think the general thinking is that, gains in the equity market strictly through valuation expansion are pretty much off the table, that, you know, in that P-E ratio, we really need to rely on the E rather than just the P to get a gain in the equity market next year. There's a lot of skepticism about earnings, the estimates where they stand for next year. But I'm curious how you're thinking, A, about earnings, and, am I right to think that valuation expansion is off the table, even if the Fed sort of pauses rather than signals a cut?
Yeah, in terms of valuation, the markets are currently trading at about 17 times forward earnings. Valuation levels had pulled back substantially heading into the June lows, and then they've sort of rallied. The valuation levels have moved up with the market heading as the markets rallied into the December highs. Right now, the outlook is for corporate profits overall to rise about 5% for the S&P 500 next year. And those numbers have been coming down. Our thinking is that earnings numbers will have to come down probably when companies start to report their fourth quarter earnings, which will be sometime in January or the second half of January. It's a tough call right now. Earnings for next year, 2023, could very well be flatter or could be negative, actually, on a year-over-year basis. But ultimately, the markets bottom ahead of earnings and the markets bottom ahead of the economy. So that's why even if there is a downturn next year, we think that the stock market can bottom sometime in the spring or summer before earnings and before the economy
right.
starts to get better.
All right, Michael, good stuff. Really appreciate you taking the time on this Friday, Christmas Eve. Michael Sheldon, he's Executive Director and Chief Investment Officer of Hightower RDM Financial Group, joining us via Zoom from Westport, Connecticut.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or stream us live on YouTube and Bloomberg.com.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.